Chapter 1. Absurdity and Meaning, by Albert Camus, translated by Helene Brown. Albert Camus, Copyright Nobel Foundation, by permission of the author. In 1957 the Nobel Prize in Literature was awarded to Albert Camus, whose clear-sighted earnestness illuminates the problems of the human conscience. Camus' background as an Algerian journalist, as an essayist and playwright, as well as his role in the French Resistance during World War II, form the wellspring of his belief in the possibility of a moral life and the consequent triumph of human value in response to the experience of the absurd. Camus' work exemplifies our capacity to impose meaning vis-a-vis the desolation of human existence. Although he is thought of as an existentialist, Camus rejected that view because of his devotion to personal moral value. Similarly, for Camus, morality is not a matter of expediency. About the work. Camus in his The Myth of Sisyphus 1 affirms that only by facing the absurd can I act authentically, otherwise I adopt a convenient attitude of wishful thinking. Although I cannot count on the consequences of my actions, my life's meaning comes from seizing awareness of what I do. I must act in the face of meaningless. I must revolt against the absurd if I am not to despair from the ultimate hopelessness of my life. From the reading. At the heart of all beauty lies something inhuman, and these hills, the softness of the sky, the outline of the trees, at this time all lose the illusory meaning with which we used to cloth them, henceforth more remote than a lost paradise. Just one thing, that thickness and that strangeness of the world, all that is the absurd. 1.1. To study. 1. Is the question of suicide or the question of the meaning of life the more serious of philosophical questions? 2. Explain how Camus clarifies the genesis of personal crises and the consequent thought of suicide as part of the human condition. 3. Carefully describe how Camus characterizes everyday existence in terms of two fundamentally different ways of esprit. 4. Characterize Camus' insights into the origins of the experience of the absurd. 5. Why do you think Camus believes that the universe cannot be understood? Clarify as to why you agree or disagree with his view. 6. Explicate, 2. The experience of the absurd. Does the absurd involve logical, physical, or emotional impossibility? 7. How can a person find meaning in existence when faced with consciousness of the absurd and the ultimate futility of reason? 8. What does it mean to live life without esprit? How does conscious revolt restore dignity to life? Is it that meaning comes not from successful personal accomplishment but from human exertion and endeavor? 1.2. The reading selection from The Myth of Sisyphus, An Absurd Reasoning, 1.2.1. Absurdity and suicide. There is only one truly serious philosophical problem, suicide. To judge whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. The rest, whether the world has three dimensions, whether the mind has 9 or 12 categories, comes afterwards. These are games one must answer first. And if it is true, as Nietzsche claims, that a philosopher should preach high example in order to command respect, one begins to understand the importance of that reply, for it will precede the definitive act. These are truths the heart can feel, yet they must be examined in depth to become clear to the mind. If I ask myself how to judge that a particular question is more pressing than any other one, I reply that it is by the actions it entails. I have never seen anyone die for the ontological argument. Galileo, who was holding a scientific truth of some importance, abjured it with the greatest ease as soon as it put his life in danger. To some extent, he did the right thing. That truth was not worth the stake. Whether the earth turns around the sun or vice versa does not fundamentally matter. To say it all, the question is futile. On the other hand, I see many people die because they consider that life is not worth being lived. I see others paradoxically being shot dead for the ideas and illusions that give them a reason for living. What is called a reason for living is also an excellent reason for dying. Thus I judge that the meaning of life is the most pressing of all questions. 1.2.2. Suicide has never been dealt with but as a social phenomenon. On the contrary, the matter we are dealing with at the outset is that of the relationship of individual thought and suicide. An act like this is prepared in the silence of the heart, as is a great work. The man himself knows nothing of it. One evening, he pulls the trigger or he plunges into existence. Of an apartment building manager who had killed himself, I was told one day that he had lost his daughter 5 years earlier. He had changed a lot since then, and that such experience had sapped him. One cannot wish for a more exact word. To begin to think is to begin to be sapped. Society has little to do with those beginnings. The worm is in man's heart. It is where it must be sought. This life or death game that leads from lucidity in the face of existence to a flight from light indeed must be followed and understood. There are many reasons for a suicide, and the most obvious generally are not the most decisive. Suicide is rarely, yet the hypothesis is not excluded, committed out of reflection. What triggers the crisis is almost always unverifiable. Newspapers often speak of private sorrows or incurable illness. These explanations are plausible, still one should know whether a friend of the man who was in despair had not the very same day talked to him with indifference. He is the guilty one. For that matter, it can be enough to well up all the bitterness and the weariness still in suspension. But if it is hard to pinpoint the exact instant, the obscure process, when the mind wagers death, it is easier to deduce from the act itself the consequences it implies. In a sense, unlike in a melodrama, to kill oneself is to confess. It is for a man to confess that life is too much and he does not understand it. But let's not look too closely into such analogies, let's return to common speech. To kill oneself is merely to confess that it is not worth the trouble. Living, naturally, is never easy. We continue to make the gestures that existence commands for many reasons, the first of which is habit. To die voluntarily supposes that one has recognized, even instinctively, the ludicrous character of that habit, the absence of any profound reason for living, the insane character of that daily agitation, and the pointlessness of suffering. What, then, is this incalculable feeling that deprives the mind of the sleep necessary to life? A world that can be explained even with bad reasons is a familiar world. But, on the contrary, in a universe suddenly deprived of illusions and lights, man feels a stranger. His exile is without recourse, since he is deprived of the memory of a lost homeland or of the hope of a promised land. This divorce between man and his life, between the actor and his setting, is properly the feeling of absurdity. All men of sane minds and bodies having thought of their own suicide, it is possible to accept without further explanation that there is a direct link between this feeling and a longing to nothingness. The subject of this essay is precisely the relation between the absurd and suicide, the exact measure in which suicide is a solution to the absurd. The principle can be laid down that for a man who does not cheat, what he believes to be true must be the measuring rule of his action. Belief in the absurdity of existence must then dictate a man's behavior. It is with legitimate curiosity that one may wonder, clearly and with no false pathos, whether a conclusion of that importance requires foregoing in no time a condition that is incomprehensible. I am thinking, of course, of men who are willing to be in harmony with their true selves. 1.2.3. In the attachment of a man to his life, there is something stronger than all the miseries in the world. The body's judgment is as good as the mind's, and the body recoils from annihilation. We get into the habit of living before we acquire that of thinking. In that race, which every day rushes us headlong to death, the body maintains its incorrigible advance. In all, this contradiction rests, in essence, in what I shall call espoir 3, because it is both less and more than diversion in the Pascalian sense. The deadly espoir that constitutes the third theme of this essay is hope. Hoping as some people practice to live another life they must merit, or cheating for others who live not for life itself but rather for some greater idea that transcends it, exalts it, gives it a meaning and betrays it. 1.2.4. Absurd walls. All great deeds and all great thought have ludicrous beginnings. Great works are often born at a street corner or in the revolving door of a restaurant. So it is of absurdity. The absurd world more than others derives its nobility from that pitiable birth. In certain situations, a man who replies nothing when asked what he is thinking about may be feigning. People who are loved know it well. But if this man's reply is sincere, if it represents that odd state of the soul, where the void becomes eloquent, where the chain of daily gestures is broken, where the heart vainly seeks the link that will connect it again, then his reply is like the first sign of absurdity. It happens that the stage sets collapse. Getting up, tramway, 4 hours, in the office or in the factory, meal, tramway, 4 hours of work, meal, sleep, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, according to the same rhythm, that path is followed easily most of the time. Except that one day, the wire rises, and everything begins in that weariness, tinged with surprise. Again, this is important. Weariness comes at the end of those actions, performed in a mechanical life, but at the same time, it unveils the conscience in motion. Weariness awakes conscience and sets the rest onward. The rest is either the return, with no conscience, to the chain-like life, or the complete awakening. At the end of the awakening, with time, comes the consequence, suicide or readaptation. In itself, weariness has something sickening. Here, I must admit that it is good. For everything begins with conscience, and nothing is worth anything except through it. There is nothing original about these remarks. But they are evident. We have enough to go on for a while, the time to do a preliminary survey of the origins of the absurd. Mere anxiety is the source of everything. Likewise, and through every day of a lustreless life, time carries us. But a moment always comes when we must carry it. We live in the future. Tomorrow, later on, when you are settled, you will see, when you are older. Such irrelevancies are admirable since, after all, it is a matter of dying. Yet a day comes when a man notices or says he is 30. Thus he is asserting his youth. But he also assumes himself in relation to time. He takes his place within it. He recognizes that he is at a certain stage, on a curve, that he confesses he will have to travel to its end. He belongs to time, and in that horror that assails him, he recognizes his worst enemy. Tomorrow, he was longing for tomorrow, whereas his whole being should make him reject it. That revolt of the flesh, that is the absurd. A degree lower, and then comes strangeness, perceiving that the world is thick, sensing to what point a stone is foreign and irreducible to us, how intensely nature or a landscape can negate us. At the heart of all beauty lies something inhuman, and these hills, the softness of the sky, the outline of these trees, at this very moment, all lose the illusory meaning with which we used to cloth them, henceforth more remote than a lost paradise. The primitive hostility of the world rises up again through millennia. For a moment, we no longer understand the world, because for centuries we have understood of it only the images and the designs we were arranging in it beforehand, because henceforth it becomes too much for us to make use of that artifice. The world evades us because it becomes itself again. That scenery, masked by habit, returns to what it really is. It withdraws at a distance from us. Just as there are days when under the familiar face of a woman we see a stranger for the one we had loved months and years ago, perhaps a time will come when we even desire what makes us suddenly so lonely. But the time has not yet come. Just one thing, that thickness and that strangeness of the world, all this is the absurd. Men, too, secrete the inhuman. At certain moments of lucidity, the mechanical aspect of men's gestures, their meaningless pantomime, makes sully everything surrounding them. A man is talking behind a glass enclosure, we cannot hear him, but we see his pointless mimicking. We wonder why he lives. Our discomfort at the fact of the inhumanity of man himself, our incalculable fall at perceiving the image of what we are, our nausea, as a writer of our time calls it, that is also the absurd. Likewise, the stranger who, at certain moments, comes up to us in a mirror, the familiar yet disquieting brother we recognize in our own photographs, that, too, is the absurd. From the reading. Through the deep-like lignting of our destiny, pointlessness becomes visible. No more rules, no effort whatsoever, are a priori justificable in the face of the gory mathematics that command our human condition. At last, I am ready to deal with the subject of death and the sense we have of it. About it, everything has been said, and it is only decent to avoid pathos. Yet it is never too surprising that everyone lives as if no one knew. It is because there is in reality no experience of death. In a proper meaning, there is experience only of what was lived and was apprehended by conscience. For that matter, it is hardly possible to talk about the experience of the deaths of others. It is a substitute, a misapprehension, and it never totally convinces us. That conventional melancholy cannot be very persuasive. The horror comes in reality from the mathematical aspect of the event. If time frightens us, it is because first comes the demonstration, then afterwards the solution. All the flowery speeches about the soul will be conclusively proved otherwise, at least for a while. From that inert body on which the slap no longer makes a mark, the soul has vanished. Such elementary and conclusive side of the adventure is the very substance of the absurd feeling. Through the deep-like lighting of our destiny, pointlessness becomes visible. No more rules, no effort whatsoever are a priori justifiable in the face of the gory mathematics that command our human condition. 1.2.5. Whatever may be the play on words and the acrobatics of logic, to understand is above all to unify. The deepest desire of the mind, even in its most elaborate operations, encounters the unconscious feeling of man in the face of his universe. It is an insistence upon familiarity and an appetite for clarity. To understand the world is for a man to reduce it to the human, to stamp it with his seal. The cat's universe is not the universe of the anthill. The truism, all thought is anthropomorphic, has no other meaning. Likewise, the mind that seeks to understand reality finds itself satisfied only by being able to reduce it to terms of thought. If man granted that the universe was capable also to love and to suffer like him, he would be reconciled. If thought would ever discern in the shifting mirrors of phenomena eternal relations that might sum them up and be themselves subsumed in a single principle, then we could properly speak of happiness of the intellect, of which the myth of the blessed would only be a laughable imitation. That nostalgia for unity, that appetite for the absolute, illustrates the essential impulse of the human drama. But just because that nostalgia exists does not imply that it must be appeased immediately. For if, bridging the gulf that separates desire from conquest, we assert with harmonize the reality of the one, whatever it may be, we fall in the laughable contradiction of a mind that asserts total unity and proves by its very assertion its own difference and the diversity it claimed to resolve. It is another vicious circle quite sufficient to stifle our hopes. 1.2.6. Hence the intelligence, too, tells me in its own way that the world is absurd. Its opposite, blind reason, claims, only in vain, that all is clear. All the same, I was looking for proof and wishing that reason were right. But despite so many centuries of excessive claims and over the heads of many eloquent and persuasive men, I know that it is false. At any rate, on this plane, there is no happiness if I cannot know that universal reason, whether practical or moral, that determinism, those categories that explain everything, can make the honest man laugh. They have nothing to do with a mind. They negate its profound truth, which is to be shackled. In this unintelligible, unlimited universe, man's fate henceforth assumes its meaning. A horde of irrationals has sprung up and surround him until his ultimate end. With repossessed lucidity, now well focused, man's sentiment of the absurd becomes clearly sighted and precise. I was saying that the world is absurd, but I was too hasty. This world in itself is not reasonable, that is all one can say. But what is absurd is the confrontation of this irrational and of the wild inward desire of clarity whose call echoes in the human heart. The absurd depends as much on man as on the world. It is all, for now, what links them together. It binds them one to the other as only hatred can weld beings. That is all I can perceive clearly in this boundless universe where I pursue my adventure. Let us pause here. If I hold to be true that absurdity that governs my relations with life, if I become good with this feeling that seizes me in the fact of the grandiose sights of the world, with this lucidity that is imposed on me by the pursuit of a science, then I must sacrifice everything to these certainties, and I must look at them fixedly to be able to keep them as such. Above all, they must be the rule of my conduct and all their implications pursued. I am speaking here of honesty. But I want to know beforehand if thought can live in those deserts. 1.2.7. Part 7. All these experiences agree and confirm one another. Having reached its most outward limits, the mind must make a judgment and choose its conclusions. There stand the suicide and the reply. But I want to reverse the order of the inquiry and start out from the adventure, cited by the intelligence, and then come back to everyday gesture. The experiences I am evoking were born in the desert that we must not leave. At least, one needs to know how far out they extended. At this point of his effort, man stands face to face with irrational. He feels, with all his senses, his inward desire for happiness and for reason. The absurd is born of this confrontation between man's call and the unreasonable silence of the world. This is what we must not forget about. We must have a good grip on it, because the whole consequence of life can emerge from it. We have together the irrational, the human nostalgia, and the absurd that springs up from their encounter, the three characters of the drama that must necessarily end with all the logic of which an existence is capable. 1.2.8. Philosophical suicide. If I accuse an innocent man of a monstrous crime, if I tell a virtuous man that he coveted his own sister, he will reply that it is absurd. His indignation has a comical aspect of its own. But it has also its fundamental reason. The virtuous man illustrates, by his reply, the conclusive antinomy that exists between the act I am attributing to him and his lifelong principles. It is absurd, it means it is impossible, but also it is contradictory. If I see a man armed only with a sword attack a group of machine guns, I may very well think that his action is absurd. But it is solely by virtue of the disproportion between his intent and the reality he can expect, or of an existing contradiction I see between his true resource and the aim he has in view. Likewise, we may very well deem that a verdict is absurd by contrasting it to the verdict the facts apparently dictated. Still likewise, one demonstrates by the absurd, by comparing the consequences of the reasoning process with a logical reality to be established. In all these cases, from the simplest to the most complex, the absurdity will be all the more significant that the distance grows wider between the two terms of the comparison. There are absurd marriages, challenges, rancors, silences, wars, and even peace agreements. For each of them, the absurdity springs from a comparison. Therefore, I am justified to say that the feeling of absurdity is not born of a fact or of an impression, being merely examined, but that it bursts from the comparison between a fact and a certain reality, or between an action and the world that transcends it. The absurd is essentially a divorce. It lies in neither one of the two elements compared. It is born of their confrontation. On the plane of intelligence, I can therefore say that the absurd is not in man, if such a metaphor could have meaning, nor in the world, but rather in their presence together. For now, it is the only link that binds them together. If I want to stick to these truths only, I know what man wants, I know what the world offers him, and now I can say that I know also what binds them. There is no need to go any deeper. A single certainty is enough for him who seeks. The only matter is to draw all the consequences from that certainty. 1.2.9. On carrying this absurd logic to its conclusion, I must admit that this struggle implies a total absence of hope, which has nothing to do with despair, a constant refusal which must not be confused with renunciation, and a conscious dissatisfaction which must not be compared to the restlessness of the young. Everything that destroys, skips, or conjures away these requirements, and, to begin with, consent which skips over divorce, ruins the absurd and depreciates the attitude that may then be suggested. The absurd has meaning only insofar as we do not agree to it. There is evidence of a fact that seems utterly moral: a man is always a prey to his truths. Once they have been accepted, he cannot free himself from them. He does have to pay something. A man who has become conscious of the absurd is forever bound to it. A man with no hope and conscious of being so no longer lives for the future. That is natural. But it is just as natural that he should strive to escape the universe of which he is the creator. All the foregoing has significance only on account of this paradox. 1.2.10. Part 10. Given the state of the absurd, the problem is to live in it. I know on what it is founded, this mind and this world racing against each other without being ever able to consummate their embrace. I ask for the rule of life in that state, and what is suggested leaves out its basic principles, negates one of the terms of the painful opposition, demands that I give up. I ask what such condition, which is my own, entails. I know it implies obscurity and ignorance, and I am assured that this ignorance explains everything and that this darkness is my light. But there is no answer here to my intent, and this lyrical exaltation cannot hide the paradox from me. One must therefore turn away. Kierkegaard may well warn out, If man had no conscience of the eternal, if at the bottom of all things there were merely an untamed force of ebullient energy producing everything, both the great and the futile, in the maelstrom of obscure passions, if the bottomless void that nothing can fill lay hidden under all things, then what else were life but despair? This cry is not likely to stop the absurd man. To seek what is true is not to seek what is desirable. If in order to escape the anxious question, what else were life? One must, like the donkey, feed on rosy illusions, then the absurd mind, rather than giving in to falsehood, will prefer to adopt for himself, with neither fear nor trembling, Kierkegaard's reply, despair. All things considered, a determined soul will always manage. 1.2.11. Absurd freedom. Now the main thing is done. I hold a few truths that I cannot let go. What I know, what is certain, what I cannot deny, what I cannot reject, this is what counts. I can deny everything of that part of me that lives on vague nostalgia save this longing for unity, this need to solve, this insistence upon clarity and cohesion. I can refute everything in the world that surrounds me, everything that hurts or enraptures me except this chaos, this chance of a checkmated king and this divine equivalence that rises from anarchy. I do not know whether this world has a meaning that transcends it. But I know that I do not know that meaning and that it is impossible at the moment to know it. What good to me are meanings if assigned out of my conditions? I can understand only in human terms. That which I touch, that which resists me, that is what I understand. And these two certainties, my appetite for absoluteness and unity, and the irreducibility of this world to a rational and reasonable principle, I also know that I cannot reconcile them. What other truth can I affirm without lying, without interjecting a hope, which I do not have and which means nothing within the limits of my condition? If I were a tree among trees, cat among animals, this life would have a purpose, or rather there would be no problem, for I should belong to this world. I should be this world to which I am now opposed by my whole conscience and my whole demand upon familiarity. This ludicrous reason is what puts me in opposition to the whole creation. I cannot cancel it with a stroke of a pen. What I believe to be true I must therefore preserve. What seems to me so evident, even against me, I must support. And what is the origin of this conflict, of this hiatus between the world and my mind but the conscience I have of it? If I want to maintain it, I can with a perpetually attentive, ever a new conscience, stretch to utmost tension. This is for now what I must remember. At this moment, the absurd so evident and yet so difficult to conquer reintegrates into a man's life and again finds its homeland. At this moment, too, the mind can still decide to leave the irritant dried-up road of lucid effort. That road now meets up with daily life. It encounters the anonymous world of V1, but man enters it henceforth armed with his revolt and his clear-sightedness. He has forgotten how to hope. He is in the hell of the present, his kingdom at last. All problems take on their sharp edges again. Abstract evidence retreats in the face of a lyricism of forms and colors. The spiritual conflicts become embodied and return to the pitiable and magnificent shelter of man's heart. None is solved. But all are transfigured. Is one going to die, leap and escape, regal dimension of ideas and forms to one's own scale? On the contrary, is one going to take on the heart-rending and marvelous wager of the absurd? In this regard, let's make a last effort and draw all our conclusions. The body, the tender feeling of love, creation, actions, human dignity, will then resume their places in this senseless world. At last man will again find there the wine of the absurd and the bread of indifference, with which he sustains his greatness. Let us insist again on the method, it is a matter of being persistent. At some point along his way, the absurd man is solicited. History lacks in neither religions nor prophets, even without gods. He is asked to leap. All he can reply is that he does not quite understand, that it is not evident. He wants to do only what he fully understands. He is told absolutely that it is a sin pride, but he does not understand the notion of sin, that perhaps hell is his final destination, but he has not enough imagination to visualize such a strange future that he is losing immortal life, but this seems to him of little importance. An attempt is made to get him to admit his guilt. He, within himself, feels innocent. To tell the truth, that is all he feels, his incorrigible innocence. Indeed, this is what allows him everything. Hence, what he demands of himself is to live solely with what he knows, to do with what is, and to interject nothing that is not certain. He is told nothing is. But this is at least a certainty. And it is with this that he must deal. He wants to know whether it is possible to live with no escape. Now, I am ready to approach the notion of suicide. One has already sensed the solution that can possibly be given. At this point, the problem is reversed. It was previously a matter of finding out whether or not life had to have a meaning to be lived. It now appears, on the contrary, that it will be lived all the better if it has no meaning. To live an experience, that particular experience of life, is to accept it fully. Now, no one will live this fate, knowing that it is absurd, unless he does everything to keep before him that absurd brought to light by the conscience. To negate one of the terms of the confrontation that keeps the absurd alive, is to escape from it. To abolish conscious revolt, is to elude the problem. The theme of the permanent revolution is thus carried into individual experience. Living is to keep the absurd alive. To keep it alive, is above all to look at it. Unlike Eurus, the absurd dies only when we turn away from it. One of the only coherent philosophical positions is thus revolt. It is a timeless confrontation of man and his own obscurity. It is insistence on an impossible transparency. It challenges the world anew every single second. Just as danger provides man the unique opportunity to seize conscience, so the metaphysical revolt extends conscience to the whole of the experience. Revolt is that constant presence of man of his own self. It is not aspiration, for it is devoid of hope. This revolt is but the certainty of a crushing fate without the resignation that ought to go with it. This is where we see to what extent the absurd experience differs from suicide. It may be thought that suicide follows revolt. But it is wrong, for it is not the logical outcome of it. It is exactly its opposite, because of the consent it presupposes. Suicide, like the leap, is acceptance to its extreme limit. It is all consummated. Man reintegrates his own history. His future, his only one and dreadful future, he discerns it and blindly rushes toward it. In its way, suicide is a solution to the absurd. It engulfs the absurd into the same death. But I know that in order to keep alive, the absurd cannot be resolved. It escapes suicide to the extent that it is simultaneously conscience and rejection of death. It is, at the extreme limit of the condemned man's last thought, that shoestring of which he catches sight, in spite of everything, a few feet away, on the very brink of his dizzying fall. The opposite of the man who dies of his own hands, in fact, is the man condemned to death. This revolt gives life its value. By its constant presence all the way of life, revolt restores dignity to it. To a man who has no blinders, there is no greater sight than that of intelligence at grips with a reality that transcends him. The sight of human pride cannot be excelled. Any sort of expressions of lesser value will not do. That discipline that the mind imposes upon itself, that will forged out of nothing, that face-to-face struggle have something mighty and unique about them. To impoverish this reality whose inhumanity gives man his dignity is tantamount to impoverishing man himself. I understand, then, why the doctrines that explain everything to me also weaken me. They relieve me of the weight of my own life, and yet I must carry it alone. At this crucial moment, I cannot conceive that a skeptical metaphysics will become part of an ethics of renunciation and that they will do well together. Conscience and revolt, these refusals, are the opposite of renunciation. Everything irreducible and of passion in a human heart quickens them, on the contrary, with its own life. The matter is to die, unreconciled and without consenting. Suicide is a repudiation. The absurd man can only exhaust everything out of all things, and exhaust himself. The absurd is his extreme tension, which he maintains constantly, by solitary effort, for he knows that in conscience, and that day-to-day revolt he gives proof of his only truth, defiance. That is a first consequence. This is the end of the reading. Notes. 1. Albert Camus, La Mythe de Sisyphe, in Les Essais Numero XII Paris, Gallimard, 1942. 2. Explication is a clarification of a term in as exact terms as possible and is an account or how the term is informed by other related ideas. Further, often insight into the meaning of the term can be had by informal explanations and examples. 3. Escape, a way of escaping the essential cleverly,